pathological idea back to the elements in the psychic life of the patient to which it owes its origin, this idea has crumbled away and the patient has been relieved of it. In view of the failure of our other therapeutic efforts, and in the face of the mysteriousness of these conditions, it seems to me tempting, in spite of all difficulties, to press forward on the path taken by Breuer until the subject has been fully understood. We shall have elsewhere to make a detailed report upon the form which the technique of this procedure has finally assumed, and the results of the efforts which have been made. In the course of these psychoanalytical studies, I happened upon dream interpretation. My patients, after I had obliged them to inform me of all the ideas and thoughts which came to them in connection with a given theme, related their dreams, and thus taught me that a dream may be linked into the psychic concatenation which must be followed backwards into the memory from the pathological idea as a starting point. The next step was to treat the dream as a symptom, and to apply to it the method of interpretation which had been worked out for such symptoms. For this, a certain psychic preparation of the patient is necessary. The double effort is made with him to stimulate his attention for his psychic perceptions and to eliminate the critique with which he is ordinarily in the habit of viewing the thoughts which come to the surface in him. For the purpose of self-observation, with concentrated attention, it is advantageous that the patient occupy a restful position and close his eyes. He must be explicitly commanded to resign the critique of the thought formations which he perceives. He must be told further that the success of the psychoanalysis depends upon his noticing and telling everything that passes through his mind, and that he must not allow himself to suppress one idea because it seems to him unimportant or irrelevant to the subject, or another because it seems nonsensical. He must maintain impartiality towards his ideas, for it would be owing to just this critique if he were unsuccessful in finding the desired solution of the dream, the obsession, or the like. I have noticed in the course of my psychoanalytic work that the state of mind of a man in contemplation is entirely different from that of a man who is observing his psychic processes. In contemplation there is a greater play of psychic action than in the most attentive self-observation. This is also shown by the tense attitude and wrinkled brow of contemplation, in contrast with the restful features of self-observation. In both cases, there must be concentration of attention, but besides this, in contemplation one exercises a critique, in consequence of which he rejects some of the ideas which he has perceived, and cuts short others, so that he does not follow the trains of thought which they would open. Towards still other thoughts he may act in such a manner that they do not become conscious at all, that is to say, they are suppressed before they are perceived. In self-observation, on the other hand, one has only the task of suppressing the critique. If he succeeds in this, an unlimited number of ideas which otherwise would have been impossible for him to grasp come to his consciousness. With the aid of this material, newly secured for the purpose of self-observation, the interpretation of pathological ideas as well as of dream images can be accomplished. As may be seen, the point is to bring about a psychic state to some extent analogous as regards the apportionment of psychic energy, transferable attention, to the state prior to falling asleep, and indeed also to the hypnotic state. In falling asleep, the undesired ideas come into prominence on account of the slackening of a certain arbitrary, and certainly also critical, action, which we allow to exert an influence upon the trend of our ideas. We are accustomed to assign fatigue as the reason for this slackening. The emerging undesired ideas as the reason are changed into visual and acoustic images. Cf. The Remarks of Schleiermacher and others, page 40. In the condition which is used for the analysis of dreams and pathological ideas, this activity is purposely and arbitrarily dispensed with, and the psychic energy thus saved, or a part of it, is used for the attentive following of the undesired thoughts now coming to the surface, which retain their identity as ideas. This is the difference from the condition of falling asleep. Undesired ideas are thus changed into desired ones. The suspension thus required of the critique for these apparently free-rising ideas, which is here demanded and which is usually exercised on them, is not easy for some persons. The undesired ideas are in the habit of starting the most violent resistance, which seeks to prevent them from coming to the surface. But if we may credit our great poet-philosopher Friedrich Schiller, a very similar tolerance must be the condition of poetic production. At a point in his correspondence with Körner, for the noting of which we are indebted to Mr. Otto Rank, Schiller answers a friend who complains of his lack of creativeness in the following words. "The reason for your complaint lies, it seems to me, in the constraint which your intelligence imposes upon your imagination. I must here make an observation and illustrate it by an allegory. It does not seem beneficial, and it is harmful for the creative work of the mind, if the intelligence inspects too closely the ideas already pouring in, as it were, at the gates. Regarded by itself, an idea may be very trifling and very adventurous, but it perhaps becomes important on account of one which follows it. Perhaps in a certain connection with others which may seem equally absurd, it is capable of forming a very useful construction. The intelligence cannot judge all these things if it does not hold them steadily long enough to see them in connection with the others. In the case of a creative mind, however, the intelligence has withdrawn its watches from the gates, the ideas rush in pell-mell, and it is only then that the great heap is looked over and critically examined. Messrs. Critics, or whatever else you may call yourself, you are ashamed or afraid of the momentary and transitory madness which is found in all creators, and whose longer or shorter duration distinguishes the thinking artist from the dreamer. Hence your complaints about barrenness, for you reject too soon and discriminate too severely." Letter of December 1st, 1788. And yet...